Welcome to the teaching ministry of Grace Fellowship Church in Bradenton, Florida. We invite you to join our pastor, William Rogers, as he continues his study of prophecy and his verse-by-verse study of the book of the Revelation of Jesus Christ.
We are continuing our subject of heaven as we look at the book of Revelation, chapter 21. Some have called this description of what we're looking at the capital city of heaven, which I think is a name that John MacArthur gives it. Nowhere does it say it's the capital city. It's not like you could think of a capital, but it is definitely a city in heaven. And we are to take God's word literally unless we're told not to take it literally, so I really believe this is a city. Bob, would you read verses 9 through 18 tonight?
Yes.
We'll finish through verse 18 tonight, I think.
If you read Revelation 21, verses 9 through 18, and this is the Word of God. Then one of the seven angels who had the seven bowls full of the seven last plagues came and spoke with me, saying, "Come here, I will show you the bride, the wife of the Lamb." And he carried me away in the Spirit to a great and high mountain, and showed me the holy city, Jerusalem, coming down out of heaven from God, having the glory of God. Her brilliance was like a very costly stone, as a stone of crystal clear jasper. It had a great and high wall with 12 gates. Can I skip something? As a stone of crystal clear jasper. It had a great and high wall with 12 gates, and the gates 12 angels, and names were written on them, which are the names of the 12 tribes of the sons of Israel. There were 3 gates on the east, and 3 gates on the north, and 3 gates on the south, and 3 gates on the west. And the wall of the city had 12 foundation stones, and on them were 12 names of the 12 apostles of the Lamb. The one who spoke with me had a gold measuring rod to measure the city, and its gates, and its wall. The city is laid out as a square, and its length is as great as the width, and he measured the city with the rod. 1,500 miles its length and width and height are equal. And he measured its wall, 72 yards according to human measurements, which are also angelic measurements. The material of the wall was jasper, and the city was pure gold, like clear glass.
That's good. You know, we've said this many times in here. If you were to describe heaven based on what you know without reading the Bible, you would be, boy, you would not have any way to really describe it, except maybe things you have heard. But we as Christians have the Bible, and yet you could probably ask most Christians to describe heaven, and they cannot do it either. They do not know. They have not heard much about heaven. But this heaven that we're looking at is our eternal home. The description of this city in heaven actually begins in verse 9 and goes through chapter 22, verse 5. Look at verse 5 of chapter 21. "Behold, I am making all things new," and he said, "Write, for these words are faithful and true." That's really the introduction to this city that he's going to describe. Look at chapter 22, verse 6. "And he said to me, 'These words are faithful and true. The Lord, the God of the spirits and the prophets, sent his angel to show his bondservants the things which must shortly take place.'" And there's the other side of this. They're like bookends. One begins the city, and then the other begins the closing of the book and the exhortations that follow the description of the city. So this city that's located in heaven takes up this much scripture. And he's giving us this description because of the information that God has told him when he said, "Write this." In fact, we find 6 times in the book of Revelation, John's being told to write. Now, out of this section, we have already begun to look at this city is not like any other city. This is actually a fulfillment to John chapter 14, verses 1 and 4, verses 1 through 4. "In my Father's house are many dwelling places. The Father's house actually is the New Jerusalem. It is the abode of God. It's where God lives. Now, that's anthropomorphic in nature, in the sense that we say a phrase like, I live somewhere, or I live here, and to say God lives there is to apply that kind of a phrase to Him. But because it's New Jerusalem, and this is the abode of God, this is where God will live, and His people will live with Him forever. This is the fulfillment to John chapter 14. In those few verses that we saw, John is writing about something that he has never seen. He's writing about words that he heard Jesus say, and then 50 years after Jesus said them to him, he is being told by the Holy Spirit to write the words of the Gospel of John. Interestingly, that he has written the Gospel of John before he had this vision. And so, but when he wrote the Gospel of John and he penned John 14, he had not been taken up in the Spirit to heaven yet. So it's just interesting to think along those lines as far as dates or times in the Bible or fulfillments of things in the Bible. But chapter 21, verse 2, we begin to look at this city that he calls New Jerusalem. And we remember this city being New Jerusalem and being compared to no other Jerusalem ever, only in name. And so this is not a reference to the kingdom, the Jerusalem in the kingdom. This is not a reference to Jerusalem in the tribulation period, or this is not Jerusalem before the Gentiles took over. It's not a reference to any of those. It is the New Jerusalem. And then verse 3, the tabernacle of God is among men. The city is where we live. The city is where God dwells. There's no temple in it. Because of what we find in chapter 21, verse 22, I saw no temple in it. Meaning, there was no temple in it. And there was no need of a temple in it. And we'll find that explanation laid out in verses 10 and 11. So here's the fact of the Father's house is being described. And John has the privilege of describing what was actually promised to him in John chapter 14, which was on the night before Jesus was crucified. And so we find that just all interesting to kind of piece it all together, that Jesus made this promise to him. In John 14, Jesus was giving us a promise of our eternal home. Now, you would think everybody would believe that. What I just gave you was not a story. What I just gave you was truth, facts according to the Bible. But I am convinced more people do not believe what I just said than there are of people that do believe what I just said. It's incredible. One of the meanest letters I've ever gotten was because I referenced John 14, and referencing John 14 to the rapture and the fulfillment of the rapture or our eternal home in heaven, along with the birthday of the church. You would think those are not controversial. You would think you would get a letter referencing something like being amillennial or postmillennial or even heresy related to the cross or the resurrection. But to give those two things, you would never think that would cause a controversy. But I have found out they do. And it is absolutely amazing that they do. So when we look at this, we are looking at, and here again, we're looking at what we take as we take it at face value for what it actually says. Now, we are told in certain places the word L-I-K-E. That's like. When you see the word like, it means like. It's not the actual, but like something. And so we can use that word for that. So when we see that word like or as is not there, then we're told to take it literal. And so we're going to be looking at this description of the city as a literal description. It's, we're told first, it is a literal city. This is a real place. It's a very real place. And I am amazed that so many people don't think this is a real place. They think that the word city doesn't really mean a city. It's just something for us to relate to. The word walls, W-A-L-L-S, doesn't mean literal walls. 1,500 or 15,000 square miles doesn't mean that. It means similar to, or it can mean just great. And so I look at that and I think, well, you know, you really have a convenient way to explain things when you can say it doesn't mean that. Don't you? I mean, no matter what you read in the Scripture, if you don't like what it says, you can say, but it doesn't actually mean that. It means something else. And so you have a way of escape. Which I don't know why we want a way of escape, but there is that possibility. So we look at verse 9, we see that we are beginning a section that is describing this city of which we began last week. And in describing this city, we realize that the first 8 verses were describing a general look at the at what's contained in the city as far as looking at things that are not there. And we saw those things. But now we're going to begin looking at, it's still a general view of the city, but we're going to begin looking at the people of the city. It's already been described for us who the people are in the city as far as descriptiveness using words of the New Testament that are before the book of Revelation. And now he's going to give us even more information concerning this. He says to start with, it's a holy city. It is described in much more detail than probably we would even think about heaven being described. In fact, I was talking to somebody one day and they said to me this. They said, heaven, is, you would think God would tell us something about heaven. Now this was way back. I had just become a Christian. And I said, well, the Bible does talk about heaven. Well, they said, it talks about heaven, but you can't find anything in the Bible. And I thought this was a scholar because he said, anything in the Bible, and I had read the Bible, that talks specifically about heaven. I said, really, there's nothing specific about heaven in the Bible. Nowhere. And I met that person later, and I had read the Bible. And I said, you know, I remember one time you told me that there was nothing in the Bible specific about heaven. He said, well, there are tidbits of things. He said, I know you're probably going to say you've read the Bible and you found a few things in Revelation. He said, but that's all symbols. You still don't know what heaven is. And so by that time, I still didn't know all. I knew I'd read it. So I thought, it got me again. So I still had no comeback. But when we begin this description, I want you to know, heaven is a very real place. The city is a very real city. I think what John sees is very real. Now, I know John was not seeing this as flesh sees this. For no flesh could see this, is what we need to understand about that. John is in the Spirit, and he is reminding us through this that he is not in his flesh seeing this. But that does not diminish what he sees. When he sees this through visions that God gives him, God is perfectly capable of giving him a full, detailed picture in the Spirit, even though it's not eyes like we have in the fleshly eyes. Do you think that's possible? Do you think God could give him a vision to see heaven the way it really is, even though he's not in the flesh?
God can do anything.
That's what I would think. I would think, well, you know, that's probably a pretty good answer. So, I want you to know, again, as we see this, we are seeing a description of something real. In fact, if city doesn't mean city, wall doesn't mean wall, miles doesn't mean miles, then do words like angels mean anything? Do words like trumpets, bowls, or judgment mean anything? Or let me give you this word. God. What about that word? You see how you can get yourself in trouble real quick? I'll never forget, and I know I've said this before, W.A. Criswell The very first chapel he spoke when I was at Criswell Bible Institute, when I first went there, it was called Criswell Center for Biblical Studies to get my undergraduate degree. He said this. He said, you know, and I did not know, but he said, you know, which means you should know, but you probably don't, but the pastor behind the pulpit knows, that there are a lot of people out there that say the Bible is not inspired all the way through, but it's inspired in spots. And so he used to say, men, I want you to hear one phrase that I'm going to give you today. If you don't hear anything else, and I don't remember anything else he said, but I remember what he told me to remember. He said, remember this. And so I remembered it. Here's what he said. If the Bible is inspired in spots, then I've got to be inspired to pick out the spots. Otherwise, I'm left to assume that the Bible is the fully inspired Word of God. I thought, wow, that was cool. And I remembered that. But that is so true, isn't it? If the Bible is inspired in spots, then God's going to have to inspire me to pick out those spots, which these liberal professors think they've got. And then, of course, I've been finding out throughout my whole life as a Christian, there are plenty of people out there that simply do not believe this is true. So, when we get to verse 9, we're looking at a holy city, it says, given by a literal angel is speaking to John, who had the seven bowls, and we said this angel is brought to the mind, even though he's in the spirit, of John, who remembers this angel from the seven angels who have the seven last plagues, the seven bowl judgments, of the worst, most intense, fastest, most destructive judgments of all. One of those angels who had one of those bowls is this angel speaking. And John remembers him, which is interesting to me. I thought about this so much this week. What are the characteristics of an angel? John's not telling us. He doesn't. If you'll notice when you go through here, really angels aren't described that much. Are they?
No.
But you hear John and he remembers back over in John 15, and yet he's remembering here, I've seen you before. You're one that had those last judgments. Those were powerful judgments. And so he remembers him, but he is giving a description of the place where we will live forever. And I don't know if the full reality of that will ever hit us, if it will ever pierce our fake souls like you would think it would do. I remember a pastor one time asked our group, he said, how many of you believe that the rapture could happen any moment, that you believe in the second coming of Jesus very soon? Every hand went up. He said, all right, now I'll ask you another question. Now, how many of you believe the second coming could happen real soon? Everybody looked around the room. He said, wait, I thought he just asked that. Well, I'll raise my hand again. So he asked the question again. He said, this time I want you to think about it before you raise your hand. How many of you believe the second coming could happen real soon? I didn't put my hand up. I thought, this is a trick question. I'm not fixing to get it. Something's going on here. And he said this. He said, if we really believed it, what difference would it make in our life? And I thought, I think he's right. In fact, Peter talks about that. It would change our whole conversation we have with people if we really believed it. John believes what he's giving us here. John believes this because he has seen it. He has been told to write it. In fact, we're going to see some other interesting information as we move through here. Verse 10, he's looking at the city, and look at what it says. He carried me away in the Spirit. There's that reminder that he is in the Spirit, that he's not in the flesh. He's in the Spirit. To a great high mountain. Now, was there a mountain in heaven? He carried him away to a great high mountain, it says. So I take it to mean he carried me to a high mountain.
Mm-hmm.
And he showed me something. Obviously from the vantage point of being high in an overall view. And he showed me the holy city, Jerusalem. And then he says, and we looked at, began looking at this last week, coming down out of heaven from God. And so this city, he's characterizing by the descriptiveness of what he sees from that vantage point, being in a high place, looking at what he is calling a holy city, and he's not saying it looks holy, it might be holy, that's the name. He's calling it a holy city. Who's calling it? The angel is. The angel is calling it this. He carried me away in the Spirit to a great high mountain, and he showed me the holy city. Now, it's interesting to think, did the angel say to him, it's a holy city, or was John able to look and describe it for himself as a holy city? Because look at verse 2. I saw the holy city. Now, I think he was probably told this is the holy city. It's all new to him. This is a reference, I think, to Hebrews, beginning in chapter 11, talking about Abraham looking for the city whose builder and founder with the foundations laid that was of God. And here he is giving us this, a city with foundations, and the builder is God. In fact, God even lives here. And it's an amazing thing that he's given us here. So verse 9, we see the general appearance. He's beginning to lay it out. And then he tells us that this city is a holy city. And he gives it the name Jerusalem, coming down out of heaven from God. Now, when you look at coming down out of heaven from God, I think he's telling us that this heaven is coming down above the earth, but he's giving us a significant thing here. He's showing us this is not something created. This is something coming to what has already just been created. It's now coming down to rest, either just above the earth or on the earth. And I think that's why he is laying this out like this. It is not telling us that this is something brand new. This is the abode of God. I think God has always lived here. And he's bringing it now to the earth, to this new part that has been newly created. And he's coming through the new heaven above the earth. The abode of God is coming down. And of course, I realize that when I'm saying coming down, we can't visualize what that is except by what John actually gives us. And so we see that this one who is speaking to him is telling him this and is speaking to him concerning a descriptive word to describe this heaven. But it's coming down, he says, out of heaven from God. What in the world could that possibly mean? Coming out of heaven, except that this is the Father's house, this is the abode of God, and this city is coming from that. Whatever that means. We can't really say what it means. So, as he is speaking to him, I can't help but wonder what was John thinking as he is seeing this. And of course, I have thought that all the way through as he's describing this. And he says to this in verse 9, remember he described it, I will show you the bride, the wife of the Lamb. And then he gives him the holy city, Jerusalem, coming down out of God, out of heaven. Amazing. Now, when he says the bride, again, let me emphasize, because I've got some questions this week. The bride in the New Testament that is spoken of clearly in Ephesians is us. It's the bride of Christ. It's the church that was born at Pentecost and will go and be until the rapture of the church. That is the full length of the church. Pentecost to the rapture. Right? But that's not what's talking about here. When the bride is talking about here, the bride, the wife of the Lamb, here it has been included that we even saw of Revelation 19 to include the Old Testament saints, Revelation 20, the tribulation saints. So by the time we get here, the rapture has happened. Tribulation has happened. The kingdom has happened. The heaven and earth of the old has been destroyed. And so Now you have the combination of every single person that has ever lived and has become a believer is part of the bride, the wife of God, the wife of the Lamb. And so we see this now. It has been including or inclusive. Old Testament saints are now part of the church. The church age saints are part of the church. The tribulation saints are part of the church. And the millennial saints are all part of the church. Except it's never called church. It's always called the bride. And so when we see the bride in Revelation 21, it's not like the same bride we find in Ephesians. Just a little tidbit of information here. Ultimately, the bride that was defined as the church widens at the time of the marriage supper and now includes all saints. I think that's just a very important thing to notice. The city is like a bride because the people are forever united with God to the Lamb, and it takes on the character of the inhabitants of the city. And we'll begin to see that as we move through, because remember, we've got all the way to chapter 22, verse 5, for the descriptiveness of the city that is laid out for us. So, he says, I'll show you the bride, the wife of the Lamb, and he takes him to a great high mountain. It's the idea that it's a high place, it's coming down. And again, he's repeating and is reminding us that this is not the creation of heaven here. It's not a newly created heaven coming down. It is simply the descent of what has already existed from eternity past. This heaven coming down has always been, to put it simply. We have no reason to believe anything else. I know I read in one commentary, it said, where were all the saints when God was creating the new heaven? Were they in limbo somewhere? Well, no. They're right there in the abode of God. They're right there in the Father's house. They're right there in this that's coming down. So there's always been a place. So, this spiritual journey is a very real journey. And I think the idea here is just to remind us that He is not flesh and blood. And so we see that His descriptiveness is beginning. And so we look at verse 11. It says, having the glory of God. Now, you could take this in verse 10. He carried me away in the Spirit to a great high mountain, and He showed me the holy city. There's a comma there. Now, everything after that in that verse is parenthetical. In fact, I have a parenthesis around mine that says, Jerusalem coming down out of heaven, out from God. And then out of parentheses, and then it says, having the glory of God. You see, the comma after God, that is the end of that parenthesis. And so it reads like this. Showed me the holy city, having the glory of God. Her brilliance was like a very costly stone, as a stone of crystal clear jasper. That's the way it really reads. Now, is it wrong to put the parentheses? No. Is it wrong to take them out? No. Either way is right. It's just that's the way I do it, because in most of my working of the text, I diagram the sentences so that it helps me understand the difference between either the direct object or the object and all this stuff. I still diagram. I know that's old, it's crazy, I don't ever talk about it, because everybody looks at you like, you do what? So I like to do that. My notes sometimes look crazy, but they're fun. So verse 11, we're looking at the general appearance, having the glory of God. Now that's probably the most distinguishing characteristic of anything he's going to say, is this, that it is the glory of God. It is the glory of God. When you look at the glory of God, what do you see? And you don't see something that we can relate to here. But he sees something and is immediately identifiable as the glory of God. So what does he see? Is it like a sea fog that kind of rolls in like we've seen the last couple of nights? No, he's not seeing that. What he sees is light. L-I-G-H-T. And when he sees the light, he is seeing the glory of God. And so we see this as a very distinguishing mark of the city as compared to the glory of God. And so they become synonymous because God lives there. God lives there, which means the city is taking on the characteristic of God. And what is that characteristic? We're seeing it is God's glory. Now, God's glory is who God is. And I know I'm probably not the best one to qualify what glory is or to talk about glory, except to say that in the Scriptures we see glory and we see God, but we don't really understand what they are. Now, I know last week we began to mention this. His glory is simply His attributes. When we say His glory, it is synonymous with the attributes of God. Now, what's an attribute of God? Why do we call something an attribute of God? Okay.
Something that's an intrinsic part of being.
Okay, intrinsic meaning
specific.
That's
very,
okay.
Specific and very vital.
Okay. All right. Okay. Why do we call it an attribute? What does the word attribute mean? Is what I'm looking for.
Description.
A description. Something that is attributed.
Something attributed to him.
To him.
God is love.
Very good example. Okay. What else is an attribute?
Righteousness.
Okay, his righteousness. What do you
think? I was just going to say a quality.
Okay, we could use the word quality.
Nature.
Or his nature. It really, that's what we're talking about. We're talking about something that is used, that we attribute to him, that is really who he is. And so he's not one without the other. He's really all of them. And that becomes really hard to qualify him as that. And so when we say that the glory is his attributes, how do we see those attributes? How do we see love? How do we see righteousness? How do we see the self-existent one? How do we see these things except to say that they are manifest? He is manifesting. The glory is his manifesting invisible attributes so that we can see them by way of seeing the light. Interesting. Yes, ma'am.
And I can add one more thing to that. That is who he is, each of his attributes, not just what he does, but it's who he is. And in that, not according to our understanding, our human finite understanding of that. For example, God is good. God is goodness itself, and that goodness is not my idea of goodness.
That's right.
He's perfect, holy.
Yeah,
he is a definer of what's good.
That's right. It's like when we say God is love, our mind does not automatically understand the love he is. We understand what we understand love to be. And this is the sin nature in us that qualifies things for us. Because remember now, Adam and Eve partook of the tree of what?
The
knowledge of good and evil. And that is a translation of what is profitable or not profitable for me. I can weigh those out, and when I weigh out a word and attribute it to God, my instinct is to say it's the same thing. My peace that I see is the same thing he is. Or the righteousness, the same way I describe it. Or love, the same way I describe it. And it's not. And that's a good point, Michelle. Very good point. So we look at his invisible attributes being manifested to us as light. Then when you go back through the Scriptures, and you're able to trace a light through there where we see a manifestation of God, you will see light. And then when you see the light, it helps you understand you are seeing a full manifestation of the invisible attributes of who God really is. That's incredible to me, because we look at this and we begin to understand just a little bit about the glory of God by understanding what we're actually seeing. Adam and Eve saw the light in the garden. They were seeing the Shekinah glory in that garden. And so we know that. He revealed His glory to Moses, did He not? He revealed His glory actually to the children in the wilderness. How did He do that? Well, His light was in the face of Moses when Moses went up and came back down, because Moses asked to see His glory, didn't he? So what did He let him see? The glory as it was departing him. And what did it do? It lit him up. Didn't it? In fact, they had to veil him. What was that all about? And so they saw that. And so they were seeing a manifestation of God through the face of Moses. That's another sermon. That's a sermon we could take you to in Corinthians, and where we won't take you there tonight. But we know He revealed His glory in the temple. He revealed His glory with the temple being filled with the light and then even the smoke. And we see the incense coming in there. Blazing light came down. And the sad fact is this. You can mark it. It's true. Everywhere and in each case, God revealed Himself through the light of His glory. It was rejected. Every single time He was rejected through disobedience, through pride, or through rebellion from whatever people saw Him. That's incredible to me. Because you see that He continually, even in the revelation of His light, we see His grace. Because He always brought back His glory, even though it was rejected. In fact, do you know what it means when we see and when we say that the glory of God has departed? There's a name given.
Ichabod.
I remember when I left Dolphin Way Baptist Church to go to Texas to get my schooling. Before I left, Dr. Jerry Vines was at Dolphin Way, and he was an expository preacher, and they literally kicked him out of the church, asked him to leave, and kicked him out. And on his way out, he stopped, and I don't know where he was in the church, but he said, "You know, I believe God has written Ichabod over this church." So we all began to look up Ichabod.
Yeah, I was going to say, how many of them could tell you what
Ichabod? I didn't know whether he had just become speaking tongues like a native. But when he said Ichabod, we began to realize that he was saying the glory has departed. You know, Dolphin Way, in that year, I don't know what year that was. It might have been 1980. This is what year?
2014.
Today? I don't know.
The church has never had any evidence of anything. The greatest light they had was Steve Lawson coming in there, and they kicked him out. Actually, amazing statistic. Steve Lawson coming in there. They begged, "Look, we got to have an expository preacher. We got to have somebody. They remember the good days." They get one. In fact, he's even the greater of the expositor. It's pastors. They kick him out. Today, even this day while I speak, they have an expository preacher. And they're signing petitions to kick him out. Now, what's wrong with that picture? Speak up, Tony. That's an awful picture. But then you go back and you see... He wrote Ichabod over that church. Did he? I don't know. But I'll tell you what, it sure seems interesting. But he is continually bringing back his glory. His glory actually returned to Jerusalem, to the nation of Israel, through the pre-incarnate form of a man named Jesus. In fact, it says, John says, we beheld his what?
Glory.
We beheld His glory, the glory as the only begotten of the Father. And Jesus' own mouth said, "I am the what of the world? I am the light of the world." He is the full manifestation of the attributes of God in human form. And what do the people do? They reject Him. Is that not true? And yet God's grace still comes back. Offers him. So, you know, you look at this and you think, wow, John 1:14, the world hated him and rejected the glory again. He came into his own and his own did not receive him. Isn't that amazing? And so we're going to see even a little bit later tonight how his grace is still going to give the nation of Israel full restoration. Amazing. So you see the light, you see the glory. God has displayed His glorious light numerous times through the Scriptures. And every time we can see. Even look at the Mount Transfiguration. It is described not as a transfiguration by the disciples, but as light. A blazing glory of light that He gives them. And so in the new heaven and the new earth, in the capital city, in New Jerusalem, the holy city, we see the glory of God. Look at what it says in verse 10, or verse 11. Having the glory of God. Having the glory of God. So that we could see it. Now, this is an interesting thing, because it is, we're now in the new heaven and the new earth, radiating from the center of this jewel-like city. Because look at what it says, having the glory of God, her brilliance was what?
Light.
What's that next word?
Light.
Like a very costly stone. In other words, here's the way you take that. Her brilliance wasn't a costly stone. It's like one. You see how you can take the interpretive loss, and it doesn't throw the meaning skyward or far out in left field, does it? We see the word like, we stop, and we understand it to mean what it's actually saying. Her brilliance was like a very costly stone, as a stone of crystal clear jasper. So John notices this is coming down out of heaven, and it is of divine origin, built by God from eternity past. And he says that in this general appearance, he's giving this an appearance of something that he says is like a costly stone, clear jasper, radiating the light. In fact, when he says this, let me give you Isaiah chapter 60, verse 19. You can just write that phrase down. You don't have to look it up yet. Just write it down and look at it, because it says this. You'll like this. No longer will you have the sun for light by day, nor for the brightness will the moon give you light. But you will have the Lord as an everlasting light, and your God for your glory. It's an amazing thing. In Isaiah chapter 60, verse 19. It's a beautiful verse. What a great thing. You will have the Lord as an everlasting light, and your God for your glory. This is what we see as a fulfillment of that verse. And so the first thing that strikes John as he's taken to this high mountain and looks up the city and sees the new Jerusalem is that it's the glory of God. It's blazing out of the middle of this light. He is the light of heaven. He is the light of the city. And he comes out of that city. And I think that this is giving us something here. I think John kind of describes the light for us. He makes an effort to do it in verse 11. Her brilliance, referring to the city where the glory dwells, was like a very costly stone. And this, we see, is comparing God's glory. Now, the word that's actually used here is an interesting word. There's no sense me trying to pronounce it because it's not even a Greek word. It's transliterated from the Hebrew, which makes the word used here as a Hebrew word. And it really means, and it's connected, it is a word that means and the light is a concentrated form of light, yet it radiates. In fact, I like what one author says. It's like looking at a description of all things, a light bulb. The descriptiveness of the Hebrew word is actually describing what a light bulb is. You look into a light bulb and you see a concentrated light, yet it radiates everywhere. And that's the description that we have here. Something in which light exists in a concentrated form, yet it radiates. So John sees this city not like a light bulb, but like a concentrated light that radiates. It's an interesting thing. It comes out through this city, not through a thin film over a little piece of glass like a light bulb, but it comes through what appears to him like a very costly stone, a stone of crystal clear jasper. It means the whole city looks like a costly stone. Now, here again, we can't relate to that. Because we think of a jasper, we think like what a jasper would be today. It's opaque. We looked at that last week. But you look in that time, a jasper was crystal clear. In fact, actually, the word here is actually used of a diamond. And so you put a diamond here and as a stone of a crystal clear diamond. And I really believe that's what he's giving us here. Now, I don't know much about diamonds. I do know that I've had to buy some. A couple. I know one night in we were having a big singles Bible study at my house, and Carol made mention that she was going to have to get her teaching certification in Georgia, and so you know sometimes I speak and I didn't think about what I said, and I go uh-oh, I just said that, and I have 50 witnesses. And what I said was this. You know, Carol and I have been laughing about this, and I told Carol, and I'm telling her right now tonight, and I know she's sitting right there, is that if she passes this test on the first run, I'll buy her a diamond ring. No, and there's no way on this planet. Now, I don't mean Carol sitting in this room. I mean, she was sitting in that Bible study. But there's no way on this planet Carol's going to pass that test. Well,
open mouth extract foot, right?
The singles took note of that promise. And we got word that Carol passed the test. I didn't think much of it until I got a phone call. I said, well, what diamond are you going to get her? I said, what?
What?
Did I say that? So I had to take Carol and buy her a diamond. And I will say, being as important as that test was and the grade she got, I was thrilled to actually buy her a diamond. But I don't know much about diamonds. And I know that, you know, the diamonds of today are many people call blood diamonds because of the way they come about. And I know that's a whole controversial thing. So I don't want to get into that. But I think it's perfectly clear that when he's talking about this, he's talking about something that's perfect. He's talking about something that if we were to locate a diamond today of the way he's describing the city, it would be a very costly diamond. Because we're looking at something that is perfect, has no blemish, has no spot. There is nothing, no distinguishing mark that would be of a negative in the diamond itself. And so he is saying here that this is a perfect, crystal, clear, refracted light in this city. There's nothing that would be a disqualifier here of that. Nothing going to stop this light, this glory from shining. You have what is called a perfect gem if you have a diamond like that. Now, I don't know that. I guess there are perfect diamonds, right? I don't know. I don't think I got one for Carol. But I know that it was a good quality. I remember them saying those words.
They're extremely expensive.
That's probably why I did not get one. But this is telling us that this is a massive attempt, I think, letting us know that God's light is perfect. And it's reflecting through this city. And we're seeing this. Now, I think that this, again, is given to us to give us the beauty of the city, to lay out for us the beginning look at this city, that it is a beautiful city of which could hardly be described. And so we're looking at the city in general terms, and it's interesting to take your commentaries that are written. And I know I don't have as many as some writers. I read John MacArthur today to see what he said. He said he's read 30 to 40 commentaries on Revelation before he began to write Revelation. In fact, he did his first thing through, it was called a jet tour through Revelation. But he said he had to research some 30 to 40 commentaries. And he said he's read myriads of other prophetic books. And very little was said about this chapter in Revelation. Very little. And I find that interesting. But look at verse 12. It had a great high wall. Now, what does that mean? Well, it means, very simply, it had a great high wall. Now, I want you to notice that it doesn't say how high the wall is. It doesn't give us anything to indicate how high this wall is. But it says it's a great wall. And so we look at this descriptiveness that he's given us here. It's a high wall with 12 gates. Listen to the description. It's got 12 gates, and at the gates, 12 angels. Right? Now, how many gates?
12
gates. How many angels?
12.
12 angels. And names were written on them, which are the 12 tribes of the sons of Israel. So, Each gate has an angel and a name of a tribe, right? That's important to note. This is the description. There were three gates on the east, three gates on the north, three gates on the south, three gates on the west. Now what is he doing? Why would he tell us that? Other than he's been told to tell us. Here's why. Number one, he sees it. That's the way he sees it laid out. And so when he is seeing this laid out this way, he is telling us something, and I think God is telling us something, because we immediately need a point of reference if we're going to really understand, I think, what he's saying. We understand it better with a point of reference. And the point of reference for us would obviously be to go back and to see that God is describing something here that is not just unique, but it has been in the past. We've seen this same description in the past. In fact, this is how he laid out the tribes of Israel in the first campsite. There's how many tribes?
12.
3, 6, 9, 12. North, south, east, west. What was in the middle?
The tabernacle
was in the middle. And names were written on them. Each gate had a name written on it, and those names are taken from the 12 tribes, signifying to us, probably a cue to look back to them. Because we look back to them and we see this same layout has already been seen in the past. And so we take this and we've got a great high wall. It's got 12 gates and 12 angels, and those gates have the names of the 12 tribes written on them. And then he gives them the first 13 by laying them out in these areas, north, south, east, and west. What do you think? Heaven's got a north, south, east, and west? Well, that's what it says, doesn't it? It actually says this, that there were three gates on the east, west. And so we see this as he is giving us this. There were gates, and it reminds us of the way he laid it out on earth. But on earth, we can understand the north, south, east, and west. I don't understand heaven having one. And he never mentions it again. So we don't know why there's a north, south, east, and west in heaven. But I do know when he is laying this out like this and he is describing the nation of Israel in the camp as they were traveling through the wilderness, he's also describing the way he is going to organize the millennial temple. If you remember, I laid it out like this as far as what's inside that temple as he is laying this out. Ezekiel 48, you have the same thing. Each of the gates named at the new millennial temple, which can't be this because that's the millennium and all that was destroyed. This is new. This is the abode of God that has been existent from eternity past coming down, and this is the description. So everything he had from the wilderness wanderings and the way he set up the camp with the tabernacle and the temple and then the millennial temple, all was a picture and the glory in heaven. It all pictured heaven for us that you would have never known there because you did not know what heaven was. And so he is picturing us heaven, and of course that celebrates the fact of an eternal God giving to us simply a picture of his sovereign will as he is disclosing it to let us know that if we can look at heaven and see 6,000 years ago, he was giving us information about heaven that we never caught. Right? We never caught it. You think they understood that? They probably thought, why do I? Wait, a minute, I want to get over there. How come I have to be on the left side? I want to be on the right side. So you can see that there might have been this. Look at verse 14. And the wall of the city had 12 foundation stones. Really? 12 foundation stones, and on them were the 12 names of the 12 apostles of the Lamb. Now, I want to give you something that I think is shocking. Absolutely shocking about this. When I see this, and I see the wall of the city now with 12 foundations, these 12 foundation stones, and on them the names of the 12 apostles, I got to get this straight. Okay, help me get this straight. There's 12 gates. There's 12 names on the gates. There's 12 angels. Now there's 12 foundations. So we have represented with the 12 names on the gate as the tribes of Israel. What about the foundations? Whose names are those? Who?
The apostles.
Describing for us the church. Now, you might think, well, wait a minute. That's exactly what he's doing. And who is not mentioned here? Paul.
I was just thinking of that, and could that be because Paul was not there on the day of Pentecost as...
Paul is not...
Not the beginning of
Paul was not the beginning of the church.
Right.
The apostles are looked at as the foundation stones of the church. And that blows the teaching of a lot of people out of the water. Now, Paul's message, his purpose was to bring the gospel to the church, but it was to a church already formed. The foundation is attributable to the 12 apostles. You don't find Paul listed anywhere in heaven. Does that diminish the name of Paul? No. It doesn't diminish, it doesn't elevate anything. But God chooses to show a clear distinction between Israel and the church, and they're still unique in heaven.
Yes.
It's amazing to me. And to me, that's shocking. Because that blows Les Feldick right out of the water.
Plus others.
And others, that's right. You're ultra-dispensationalists right out of the water. Now, does that mean a negative on Paul? No. Paul lived his purpose as an apostle to the church, but not as a foundation for the church. That's incredible to me. And to me, that's shocking. I wrote in my note here, notice the absence of Paul. Interesting. And so you read this, and he is telling us something. He is showing us, even in heaven, there is a clear remembrance of the nation of Israel. And even in heaven, there is a clear remembrance of the church. Now, if that's true, and there is this clear distinction, one is that the head of the gate, one is the foundation for the gate, wouldn't it be probably pretty clear that the uniqueness of the church and Israel can even withstand eschatological meanings? In other words, the church doesn't replace Israel. They can't replace Israel. The church cannot replace Israel. Israel is still in the heart and the mind of God. It's still there. Even in heaven, it's still there. In fact, we see this, we begin to see it in verse 15. You would not know that you're getting ready to see this, so I'm going to tell you you're going to see it, even though you still won't see it in verse 15. Look at verse 15. And the one who spoke with me had a gold measuring rod to measure the city and its gates and its wall. It's a real wall. They're real gates. It's a real city. And this angel is now using, instead of a reed that was used, he's using a gold measuring rod to measure the city. John doesn't ask him to do this. This is something he is telling John, let's do. We're going to measure the city. And so as he's beginning to measure this, we begin to notice, well, gosh, have we ever seen this before? There's your point of reference again. Immediately when I read this several weeks ago, I thought, measuring. What have we measured before? Well, turn back to Revelation what?
Why didn't they, if they already told us what it was, you know, with the 12 gates and the high wall and all that, why are they measuring
it? Well, let's take a look at it, okay? In Revelation chapter 11, verse 1, there was given me a measuring rod like a staff, or as translated in the Old Testament, a reed, And someone said, rise and measure the temple of God and the altar and those who worship in it. It's interesting. So we see we've already been given this before, this possibility that it must be measured. The one who spoke to me is the one doing this. In verse 15, the one who spoke with me had a gold measuring rod in his hand, or he had a gold measuring rod, to measure the city and its gates and its walls. And so the city is laid out, and he gives him the description so we know he's measuring, and the measuring rod takes us somewhere. Look at Ezekiel, and I'll show you something. Ezekiel chapter 40. Here again, goes back to what we taught in the millennium. Ezekiel 40. I love this. Ezekiel 40 through 48, all of those chapters deal with the same subject. And we looked at that subject as being the millennial kingdom's temple. And so all of this relates to that. So Ezekiel chapter 40, if you're there, notice in verse 1, the 25th year of our what?
Exile.
It's in the middle of our exile. Now what was exile? What does that word mean? It meant bondage. They've been captured, right? In fact, we can read the capture coming when you read Jeremiah, Isaiah, Daniel, if you reference it, and also Habakkuk, the dreaded coming of the Chaldeans or the Babylonians. So we begin to see this. Now in verse 2, in the visions of God, he brought me into the land of Israel. Where did he take him? To the land of Israel, and set me on a high mountain, and on it to the south there was a structure like a city. See that? Now, look at verse 3. So he brought me there, and behold, there was a man whose appearance was like the appearance of bronze, like a line of flax, and a measuring rod was in his hand, and he was standing on the gateway. You see that? And the man said to me, son of man, see with your eyes, hear with your ears, and give attention to all that I am going to show you. For you have been brought here in order to show it to you. Declare to the house of Israel all that you see. Now, what is this? What's happening here? He is measuring the temple site. And what does this tell them? Without going into the whole rest of this, this tells them that they are a part of the future. They are going to leave exile. They are going to be fully restored. And they're even going to have a new temple. And he's told it is so certain that they're to measure it. Now, why do they measure it? Because here's what he's telling them. It is going to be God's temple. This is God's temple, and he is told to measure that temple. It's a description of the millennial temple. This is the temple that will exist during the millennial reign of Christ. This is not heaven. But you can see it is a picture of what's in heaven. And it will be laid out exactly as we have seen this heavenly or holy city laid out. So when you go there, you will see that there is God's measuring the millennial temple. He's got what in his hand. He's got a 9-foot reed. He uses that 9-foot reed to measure the millennial temple. Now, the angel has what in his hand? He's got a gold measuring rod in the Revelation chapter 21. And so this is not the reed, but it is a gold measuring rod. Now, it's like a staff, like Revelation chapter 11 says, and it's also like the one in Ezekiel 40. But the temple was measured as a temporary measuring reed that could be destructed. It could be destruction. Destroyed is the word I'm looking for. It could be destroyed. Sometimes words don't come out. But the importance of the gold measuring rod is the fact that it cannot be destroyed. And so even the reed will be destroyed, and the reed here can't be destroyed. The temple was destroyed, a temporary reed with a temporary temple. This is a permanent reed measuring a permanent city. You see, the difference between, what's the difference between the temple and the city? You know what the difference would be? Do you see a difference?
Yes.
What's the difference?
One is temporary and one is permanent.
Okay, one's temporary, one's permanent. But what was the purpose of a temple?
To worship.
It was a picture of the city. It was a picture of the city where God dwells. You see that? And the difference is not just temporary and permanent, but that is the difference. But it's also, they both picture God. In other words, it was God's temple. This is God's city. It was measured by a temporary reed. It's measured here by a permanent reed. Absolutely incredible. Yes, ma'am.
So, is it safe to say that every place in Scripture where the Lord declares that He wants a temple built, all of those temples are foreshadowing of, or replicas rather, of the actual one
they
in
are.
Heaven that
they,
will be
they,
coming down?
They absolutely are.
Wow.
Except one. The tribulation temple.
Right.
It's not going to last, and it's not going to be the house of God.
No.
Right. Interesting. In fact, that's what we talked about when we talked about measuring it. He's laying out the outer court, not the actual temple proper. When you go back and read Revelation 11, that's left out because the Antichrist takes his seat in there, and that's not declared to be God's. The outer court is the people's side of it is. They are his own possession. Who? The remnant of Israel.
Wow.
It's incredible how it all begins to just fit into this we call the Bible. Isn't it amazing?
Yeah.
All in heaven. And heaven is not just this place up there. It's all very descriptive of everything we've already seen. Except we've seen the picture. There is the reality. Just like Jesus is the fulfillment of the sacrificial lamb. Right? Interesting.
You have been listening to the teaching ministry of Grace Fellowship Church in Bradenton, Florida, with Pastor William Rogers. We invite you to join us in worship every Sunday at 10:30 a.m. We are located at the corner of Manatee Avenue East and East 9th Street on the center floor of the Manatee Central Banquet Hall. We pray that you will join us again next Sunday as we continue to teach God's Word one verse at a time.